involved. So I'm going to define a special notion of equality just for bits. Whoops. So this is a relation. This is, again, a data type that takes two bits. And then there is two ways the two bits can be equal. Either they both are equal to zero, they both are zero. So then this is going to look like that. So you can read this as kind of rules. So there is one rule that says that zero is equal to zero. So basically, when there is this underscores, this is this what we call mixed fixed notation, where basically the arguments goes where the underscore goes. So I can write this syntax where the whole name is bit bracket equal bracket, and then it's used like for zero here. Then same thing for one, that one can be, can be equal to, is equal to one. Yeah, they're here. Also in AGDA we like Unicode. That's why there is all this, okay, so I got tricked by this indentation thing again. Okay, now I can use this special predicate that I've just defined, the special relation that says when two bits are equal. Okay, great. Okay, so now I do a case analysis on X. And then there is a special thing called refine. When this is obvious, which one to pick. Oops. When this is. Okay. So here is a proof that that not X is equal to X. When X is zero, the reason for why it's zero, it's because of computation. The X is zero, so not will compute to one, and then not will compute again to zero, and then I just have to say that zero is always equal to zero. Okay, so this proof is so sort of is so easy that there is the I can ask the kind of auto mode to find it for me. This is not necessarily that impressive, but generates this code. Okay, so okay, let's. So I have another example with bits, but let's move on to the next part. Then I have natural number. Usually I use Unicode everywhere, but I'm not going to push myself into too much typing in this setting. Yes, all the typos I do. This is again some indentation thing. Okay, so there is the natural numbers, right? 0, 1, 2, and they are defined with this data type that is they are 0, then successor of 0, then it's 1, then successor of 0, then it's 2, etc. Oops. Then on these natural numbers, what I want is addition. I'm going to need it later on. Okay, so addition takes two natural numbers. Yes, great. X, Y. Yes. Again, I have this, yes. Okay, so for this, I will do a case analysis on the first one. So it is either zero or successor. Then zero plus y, I know it's y. That's fine. And if I know that the first argument is made of a successor, then I know that the result is made of a successor. So I go for that. I can build a program incrementally. And then I make a recursive call on the rest. So here, you have to really think of this one as being parentheses like that. And so that the recursive call of the plus function is made on something smaller. So that's why it's accepted. AGDA only accepts this terminating functions that are defined everywhere. If I miss one case, then it says that it's that I miss one case. Okay. Okay, now list. Or maybe I go directly, okay, I have the type for list, and then, or maybe I show it on the complete file. Then I will load this. We'll load this complete file. I will do the magic trick again. Okay, so this is sort of the same thing that we've seen. It used a bit different names, but anyway. Okay, so there is the natural numbers, and addition on natural numbers. And then here is how we can define list. They are either empty, or they are made of one element followed by a list. OK, this is the cons case. And on this list, we can define the length function that is basically, if you think about it, it's going from a list to natural numbers, and it's actually sort of forgetting about the elements of the list, but preserving the structure. It maps nil to zero, and it maps cons to circ. Then on this list, one can build a concatenation function, the append function of toList. And one kind of proof that we can have is to show that, and some easy proof that we can have is to show that the length of the concatenation of two lists is the sum of the length. And the proof really goes as this two-line function that is defined by case, and this is a proof. And at the same time, if you read it as a function, it's also as a function. That's what I mean by one system with sort of the two the proofs and programs are consistent, are unified. Okay. Okay. And then to kind of finish with this demo. Vectors. So vectors is some kind of the first basic example that we have of dependent types inside on the side of programming, because dependent types were actually used in all the proofs here. So the type of vectors is a bit like the type for list, except that it tracks the length of this vector in as an index. This is the second thing. There is, for instance, the empty list. The empty vector is of size zero. And the cons case takes a vector of size n and makes a vector of size successor of n, so 1 plus n. Obviously, we can turn vectors into lists, sort of forgetting the static knowledge that we have of the length. We can also prove that when we take the length of this forget. Of this conversion of from vectors to lists, then we get n. This was the original size of the list, showing that we've not forgot any elements when we were converting this function. So this, I mean, you might get this function wrong if you, for instance, forget this part here. But then the proof will complain later on. So some parts are crucial because you can. These are the specification. These are the meaning of things, and then the proofs are the part that if it's accepted, then it's okay. Okay, and finally, you can append two vectors, and here this is where the dependent types truly shines, as the first vector is of size m and the second is of size n, and the resulting vector is of size m plus n, and this is the plus that we defined earlier. This was on program side, and now it's in the types. And when you define this function, it's really exactly defined. I don't know if we can have both on the same screen. And it's really defined exactly in the same way that the append function on list. So the fact that this function is precise about the length of things is really sort of for free here. We have the same code that we had for append. It really relies on some kind of engineering of the definition, such that the append function that we define works on the left, on the first argument, and the plus function works on the first argument as well. That's why everything sort of works out nicely. And yeah, that's the end of the demo. Okay, so let's get back here. Okay, now this was kind of general AGDA thing, and now let's go more into security and. And okay, so Okay, briefly, everyone knows about public key encryption, I hope, here. So we have a just brief recap of the notation I use. So SK for the private key, public key, PK for the public key. And so we have an encryption function called ENC. And I don't put any parentheses to pass arguments to a function, right? So ENCPKM takes the public key and a message and produces ciphertext C, and the decryption can do the reverse and needs the private key. Okay, so this is pretty straightforward. Then you have to, this picture is not as nice as I wanted to be, but this is the an important notion. This is the in-CPA security notion. And this is defined as some kind of a game that which works as follows. There is two participants, the challenger and the adversary. So the challenger represents the good guy and also the, let's say, the host system, the network, and all the paths that we trust, let's say. And the adversary here represents all the bad guys colluding between with each other. Okay, and the game works as follows. The challenger starts by generating a key pair of SK and PK, and then sends the public key to the adversary. The adversary can now encrypt as many messages as he wants, because as we know, you only need the public key to encrypt. Then the adversary has to send two messages, M0 and M1, to the challenger. He can pick the messages as he wishes. This is chosen plain text attack. Then the challenger will encrypt one of the two messages with the encryption function. And so let's say that it encrypts MB, where B is some kind of secret bit. So it's either M0 or M1 that gets encrypted, and sends this ciphertext C to the adversary. Then this adversary has to tell which one has been encrypted. Okay? And we say that if the adversary can guess sufficiently often, then we can claim that the encryption has been broken. So formally, this is defined that there is the probability of the adversary of winning, so of guessing the right bit, and we want to see the distance of this probability to one half. That is what we call the advantage. So if you guess really, if you guess always good, then you have a good advantage, and a good advantage is being away from one half, and one half is when you answer at random, or when you answer always the same thing. So the worst is advantage zero, and the best is advantage one half. Okay. So in AGDA, we can model this adversary, and there is various ways of doing so. But one way would be to say that the adversary comes into two paths. The path that computes these two messages, M0 and M1. This is then modeled as a record here, and of two paths M and B prime. And the first path takes the public key, as I said, some randomness in this. I'm going to speak a bit more about the randomness later. Let's keep that for now. And has to return a pair of messages. Then B prime takes the basically there is no state for this adversary, so we pass him back all what he got before. So he gets the same public key again, and he gets the ciphertext, and he gets to decide which B it was. Okay, does this game previously sounds trivial to break? The idea is that it's supposed to be defined such that all the trivial attacks do not work, and that all the remaining depends on the way the encryption works. Okay, so there is one trivial attack that is, imagine that your encryption function is deterministic. Then it's pretty easy. My adversary can pick any two messages, M0 and M1, as long as they are different. And then my test for the B prime would be to simply compare the ciphertext I receive with my own encryption of M1. because I choose the message that, and I can encrypt them so I can compare. And if this encryption function is deterministic, then this works. And the proof sketch would be sort of as follows, that the encryption, if it isn't deterministic, then it means that MB is equal to M1, therefore that B is equal to 1, and therefore that I guessed B. So why is this game still used if there is this, right? The point is that we are not supposed to have an encryption function that is deterministic. I mean, at least then it will fulfill different security criterion, but not the semantic security of in CPA and all what is above it. So so this the encryption should be randomized, but if you think of it of the what we call now textbook RSA, it's defined like that. That is, the public key is a pair of E, the exponent, the encryption exponent, and N, the modulus, and then the encryption is just M to the E modulo N. This is completely deterministic, this thing. So yes, RSA, if it's implemented like that, it's not secure according to this in CPA definition. That is, you can have an adversary that can pick the two messages and get that can have a clue about which one you encrypted. The thing is that RSA is not good at encrypting particular messages. It's only good at encrypting random messages. Then it's fine if M is picked at random. So that's why now RSA should be used as you encrypt you pick M at random, and this M is not your message, but is some kind of secret key for some other encryption, let's say a symmetric encryption scheme. So anyway, so randomness is paramount. Okay, so now we can see, so this way I sort of hidden this randomness thing before, and now that is made explicit. So the way we can represent this game with the two boxes, we can represent it in AGDA with this exp function that takes the bit B, so that we can choose the mode where B is 0 and the mode where B is 1. Then it takes an adversary, this is A, and then it takes all the randomness that is necessary in this game. So one point of this exercise is that usually the randomness can be made sort of implicit in the discourse, but here we really make it explicit as we think it's really necessary to clearly see things. So anyway, so this games proceed like there is this four lines. PK is created out of the key generator, then it's sent to the adversary, the M path, then one the MB message is encrypted and gets called C, and then we can pass C to the adversary again to get the resulting bit. Then the little b in the game function just below now it becomes part of the randomness. We pick this b at random, and then we obtain the game I was mentioning. Okay, so there is another trivial attack that is what if the size gets to the size gets to leak. So basically, if M0 and M1 any messages as long as they are different size, then a way of seeing which one has been encrypted is just to look is the size of the ciphertext I get of the same size of the encryption of M1. So even if I encrypt M1 with a different randomness, then it will usually crypto schemes preserve the size, and the size do not depend on the randomness. So this would work. So that's why the actual definition of in CPA is actually to require the two messages to be of the same size, right? So they knew about that. So the real definition of in CPA is that M0 and M1 are of the same size, and that we only consider randomized encryptions, okay, to defeat these two trivial attacks. Okay, so now let's speak a bit about compression together with encryption. Okay, so what if when both are good and we want privacy and we want to save some bandwidth or storage? So let's put them together. So first attempt, we encrypt and then we compress. This is useless because compression after, I mean, basically, encrypted data looks like random. And there is one thing that compression can't always do is well encrypt random. This is a matter of entropy. It's so basically, it works, but doesn't compress much. Okay, so let's do the opposite. So encryption after compression. And one way to think of it is to say that you take an encryption scheme, ENC, and then you produce a new one that will systematically, just before encrypting, will systematically compress the message. Like you don't think, right? You always compress and then you encrypt. Okay, so that we get this CENC function. And that's the part that is broken. So this is what the where the compression oracle comes in. So basically, the pair of messages can be any two messages that have the same size, right, to fulfill the requirements of this in CPA game, but will compress of a different size. And I bet that any pair of and any kind of compression scheme better be able to compress better some messages than some others, because we know that it can't compress all of them. So basically, one M0 could be sort of plenty of zeros, and M1 could be some random bit string of that same size. One will compress very well, and the other will not. And so. So the way we can write the adversary is just to look at the size of this CENC function. So this was known for a long time as some kind of a theoretical attack, that because in CPA is not protecting the length of the message, if you can encode, if you can make the length depend on the content, then chosen plain text attack can then work again. And this works basically for any compression scheme. And this assume from any encryption scheme, which is it can even be in CPA secure, the base one, and will leak the size of the plain text message by encrypting, and basically that the ciphertext does not depend on the randomness. That's a technicality that's usually okay. Okay, so now we get closer to this breach attack. That is, in 2012, it was the crime attack, which was targeting the compression that was built into TLS. It was not widely used, so this just got turned off, and this was mitigated. Breach. It's an improvement on. So what we saw is that in theory this was broken since the beginning. Each time you compress, whatever you do, each time you compress, then you encrypt. In CPA doesn't help you. And usually in CPA is considered kind of the lowest theoretical security notion for an encryption scheme. So it works for, and this breach attack works. This kind of attacks, they go further. They use a lot of ingenuity and tricks to not only make this attack work in theory, but works in practice. And not only to recover sort of one bit in the case you we pick the messages, but recover all the secret. That's what gets interesting. So this breach attack works on the HTTP responses and can get secrets like CSRF tokens, because they appear in the responses and they usually reflect part of the input. Okay, so from the paper we can explain how this let me make it bigger. This attack works is that the first thing is a URL where there is where you can you have in the parameters you can you can put something that looks like this canary could be CSRF token equal. This is something that is just the prefix before the secret that is known. Then you put your guess, and then you will get as the response something that includes your guess, and that also contains the secret below this canary D6. So the secret is D634, etc. And the thing is that if your guess is good, then the compression will work better. And so just by looking at the size of the, because you don't get this response in clear text, this is not meant for you. The setup works like that. So either you have a real man in the middle, or you can just sniff the resulting resulting response is encrypted, and just the size of it is what you need. So you will make new requests that you can do either by forcing the victim to do it, or in theory you can do it because you have the public key. So if it was just a matter of public encryption, then you have the public key, so you can send messages to the server. And in practice, there is enough stuff such that it makes this difficult. So let's say that you force the victim to send particular request, and then out of the responses you can only get the length, but when the first byte of your guess is right, then it will likely to compress better than when it's not, because there is patterns that repeat, and that's what compression is here for. So you can then therefore recover byte by byte all the secret in this way. So there is technically this that I will mention a bit later on. Okay, so this was the setup. Now I need something smaller. Yes. So basically, this would be some kind of mockup. This is some kind of a mockup of what the base version of Breach would look like in Agata. I use this for this presentation. I thought it was more fun to speak about an attack more than speak about an encryption scheme. I mean, or a construction. Yeah. It's more fun to see an attack than to see why something is secure, and usually it's more technical to see why the proof of when something is. So in the end, this is what I have about Breach. Really, in Agda is basically just a mockup, but also this compression oracle that we saw before. That was the theory behind it. So in the real Breach, there is lots of technical challenges that they had to overcome. The fact that there is not only the compression works in two layers, and there is some Huffman coding that defeats this basic version. So then there is this two tries method. So I just want to in case you don't know Breach well, that don't get confused by this simple mockup. This is more advanced than this. yes. So block ciphers can hide the length, but not totally. Sometimes you can only make a guess on a small period of time. Or anyway, so yeah, we'll have plenty of time for questions. So as a future work, we work on our end goal would be to verify a voting scheme based on cryptography. Examples of that are Helios or Prêt à Voter, or some are based on mixnets. And to do this, we need to sort of verify all the basic blocks of encryption before. There is homomorphic encryption, non-interactive zero knowledge proofs, things like the Naryov transform. There is plenty of roadblocks before that, but we are getting closer. That's the end of my talk, and we have plenty of time for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the internet? Yes, there are. Go ahead.
Hi. Do I get this right that you have this URL-like structure where you have?
Hang on a second. There's first a question from the internet.
Oh, sorry.
What?
Okay, question from IRC. Why did you decide to leave France for computer science research?
Okay, didn't really. So, in short, I didn't left for necessarily for long. This is quite common after your PhD to do a postdoc somewhere else in some other country to get more international experience, and then I hope to get a position back in France. But I'm not that, I mean, the place doesn't matter much more than like the context, the team and all that.
Hi, would the breach attack still work if this URL includes a kind of randomly created session ID? Because then your guess compresses together with the secret or the session ID.
So you think in the case where the session ID has some patterns that will repeat with the guess?
Yeah.
I think this is sort of unlikely, and if the thing is that if the session ID is the same over requests,
okay,
then I think it doesn't help.
The secret is also the same, or the secret changes every time?
Yeah, so if the secret changes every time, this is one of the way of to mitigate this headache. Yes.
Okay, we have another question from the internet.
One more question from IRC. Typically, proving a protocol needs to explore a big state space. How do you prove that your exploration function is exhaustive?
So there is two main ways of doing this kind of proofs. That is, either relying on what we would call model checking, and here it usually depends on really exploring that space. And in crypto, we would like to have huge spaces because like the keys are usually not, you can't really explore them. The idea is that we do more of symbolic reasoning, where we can deal with these functions that really do we do explore everything. I mean, like every of 2 to the 256 bit space. But we don't run these programs. We run them only symbolically. We make them they are defined by induction on there. So basically, yes, we can do proofs which will about programs that do enumerate a space that is much bigger than what we can compute.
Next question.
Could ACTA be used for reverse engineers to prove the identity of two different implementations?
I don't get why reverse engineer, but yes. I mean this can. This can be useful for this kind of thing. I mean, if you think of functional programming, it's a bit like Haskell plus proofs. That not only you can write the programs, but you can also write proofs about it. And instead of just testing that these two functions are doing the same, you can also prove that they are doing the same. Yes.
Okay. There's a microphone on your way to you, sir.
I like the general idea very much, but the weakest concept seems to be that there is no real concept for entropy in the whole system of a formal proof. So can you deal with weak random generators and say anything about the complexity? How long do you have to listen to this? Or how complex an attack has to be to give to break the cryptography with a given probability or something like this seems extremely difficult to me.
Yeah, so I expect the thing to be sort of, I mean, as we usually do, to be in modular, as in when you have a particular thing that requires randomness, we'd say, oh yeah, we pick random numbers. And then in practice, we use a pseudo-random generator, which is better be secure. So so the proof of that a pseudo-random generator is secure is when you can't computationally distinguish it from a real random generator. So if the two components were sort of proof secure with computational bounds, then you could merge them together and get the final bound. But it's true that in practice, there is always this assumption that you pick something at random, and then in practice you pick it with a pseudo-random generator, and maybe it's not that good. I mean, there is always this assumption that there is a lot, and then this is usually where the best vector attacks comes in, is to look at the assumptions that were not really sought deeply. But this is, I don't see it as a limitation. It's a challenge, yes. And randomness is really paramount in cryptography. It's, and I would say it's the main thing.
Okay, next question again from the internet.
There is another follow-up question regarding protocol proofs. Is there any particular reason to do protocol proofs in ACTA rather than COQ?
Yes. So this is a good question. And when we started this project, we knew about the Koch proof system, but we're not really experts in it. But mainly the two main reasons why we switched to ACTA, I mean, or more like to switch. So we switched to ACTA because we like the way the dependently typed programming is better integrated. But then there is, why not reuse what has already been done in Koch, like with the Gilles Barthe team. They did this CertiCrypt project and then this EasyCrypt project. So in short, there is two things in CertiCrypt that we didn't like, is that they to speak about probabilities, they have to speak, I mean, we sort of have to speak about real numbers, and real numbers in this kind of constructive logic, it's a mess. And so you end up with an axiomatic version of, or partly axiomatic version of real numbers, and this we didn't like. So we said, we don't really need real numbers because in cryptography, the kind of probabilities we do, they are only discrete. So screw that and let's not delve into real number. We want something with absolutely no axioms. This was the first reason. The second reason is that usually these games, they are represented as imperative programs, and that we don't like imperative programs, in particular because we know how difficult it is to write proofs about it. So we wanted something that would be more functional and less axiomatic. So that was the main reasons for starting over with different foundations than what was in CertiCrypt.
Could you go to the microphone?
So if I got you right, so the result of the compression should be completely random. So to have a perfect encryption after that. So, but I would assume that the result of compression can never be completely random because there is no perfect compression. So I think if you may have got close to it if you put this compression scheme into that piece of data, but then you that's not random anymore. And if you don't, where would you put the compression scheme? Because that scheme can't be random data.
Yeah. So I'm not exactly sure. I think I get the idea of but I mean this is a fundamental issue, like compression. If we want to use compression, it's because it makes some messages smaller. But we know it can't make them all smaller. I mean, it can't compress messages in the same way. And some will be compressed well, some won't. And some won't be compressed at all. and we let, there will be this dictionary at the beginning that makes things bigger. So the, if we go to the worst case, then you would have to never, I mean, to, if you want to pad the messages such that they all end up with the same size, then you end up not compressing at all. So I think that there is the only way is to sort of to hide the length of after by adding some random amount of data, but even that is usually not helping much because then it's just a bit more difficult to see because we're not going to add one gigabyte of randomness just in case. Then you defeat the purpose of compression again. This is really a fundamental issue of that combining these two features, compression and encryption.
Okay, last question. Anyone? Okay, thank you so much.